So welcome everybody to the 20th Q&A for the OPC-UG. We will have time almost certainly tonight for additional questions and so forth. So if you wanted to ask them either audibly or in the chat, we only have currently, I believe, four topics to cover. And so line up your questions for later on after we cover the material that's been prepared in advance. So we are recording to the cloud. The audio recording, the deck, and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website sometime later on this evening. And so with that, I'll kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Having muted all, right?
Oh, sorry, you're right. You know, forgot about that. Everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Feel free to do so, but remute yourself after you ask a question or make a comment so that we keep the background noise down. There we go, Alan.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Well, we have an extra topic, so there's five topics in total tonight. But we're going to start off by throwing it right back to Chris, who's got a number of shares, I think.
Yeah, so this, I had actually titled this as a beginner's topic, and I'm not sure it's really a beginner's topic, but it's something that probably puzzles some people as to why they can do certain things in some applications and not in others. And I covered this a little bit just talking about it at last week's Office Smackdown, the difference between modal dialog boxes and non-modal dialog boxes. So basically the difference really amounts to the fact that if you have a dialog box appearing over top of your content, whatever it is underneath of it, and it disables the main content underneath until you actually finish with that dialog box, that's a modal dialog box. And Microsoft Office, in this case, does use that. And pretty much every application that you can possibly have has dialog boxes, and it's up to the designer or the programmer to decide whether they'll be modal or non-modal. And rather than go through the next couple of slides, I'll end up letting Alan jump those. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to share my screen, and I'm actually going to demo this. And so share, and I'm going to bring up a document. Just because there is this difference between LibreOffice and Microsoft Office, I'll demo what happens in this. So on the right-hand side, we have Microsoft Word. And I'm just going to have to move something here so I can see things. There we go. Okay, so if I look at the my cursor is in this, in there. So it's heading one, and I can see that it's highlighted as heading one. Say I wanted to modify that. So if I come in here and I say I want to modify that, so that brings up a dialog box. And then say I decide that for this heading one, I want to modify something about, I don't know, say the font that's in use. And I actually want to modify something about the color of it. And I want to make it red. And then I think, oh, what is it that I'm actually seeing that is actually going to get modified? Well, it's covered up by that dialog box. So I can drag this dialog box out of the way. But if I click on this one, I just get a ding. I can't actually move that dialog box. I can't activate the window underneath it either. So if I want to go back to be able to see what it is that I'm actually going to be modifying in this case, I actually have to cancel this dialog box, move this dialog box, then I could go back in and I could do the format font, and then I could see, oh yeah, I see it's this stuff here that's in gold that I'm going to be actually modifying. So it's a little bit disturbing to me that, and a lot of programs will do that, where you bring up a dialog box, and then you bring up a sub-dialog box. And if your main dialog box is covering what it is you need to look at, you need to move that before you actually open up the sub-dialog box, or else you have to back up by going on the cancel and then move that dialog box. Contrast that to over on the left-hand side where we have LibreOffice Writer, and all of the LibreOffice applications work the same way. They have non-modal dialog boxes. So if I'm in this heading here and I go to Styles, Manage Styles, And say that opened up over top of here, and I decide that I actually want to modify this particular style, and it brings up this sub-dialog box. And but the difference is that I can go and drag this dialog box out of the way without having to cancel this and then move it and then go back into the sub-dialog box. I can even go back to the main window, and I can actually move it. And so that's the difference between modal and non-modal dialog boxes. For the most part, I much prefer to have non-modal dialog boxes. I'm not sure why programmers, you know, elect to have it as a modal dialog box. Maybe there's a programmer out there who can say in what instance this really makes sense to have it that you can't go back to, you know, a sub or a higher level dialog box or even the application window and, you know, move things around or deal with stuff that way. I personally don't see why. But anyway, I just wanted to show that so that if you have two applications that you're dealing with and you get a feeling, you know, there's something different about that, you might find that it's actually the difference in the modal aspect of dialog boxes.
And what's really crazy, Chris, is when they open the dialog box behind the main window.
Yeah, which should never actually happen, but you're right, it can happen.
Okay, so Chris, keep going.
Okay, VirusTotal, neat website where you can upload any executable or actually data files even as well, because it'll look for malware in whatever you upload. And because data files such as doc files can have Visual Basic for Applications, macros built into them and things like that, anything you upload will be checked by usually about 60 different anti-malware engines, all with up-to-date virus signature files. Really cool site for checking out unknown files that maybe get sent to you in email and things like that. But an interesting thing came up that I just noticed that they came out with a 2021 malware trends report. So they see over 2 million files a day from 232 different countries. So they have a unique sort of perspective into what malware is out there on an ongoing basis. So some of the key takeaways that I noted in the report, the average time for exploitation of the most popular vulnerabilities dropped from 93 days to 0 days in 2021. So it's becoming much more immediate, the impact that can happen when malware or vulnerabilities are found and bad people start to exploit them. 282% increase in malicious PowerShell files. So this is an automation engine that is built into Windows since, I think, well, it's definitely there in 10. I think it was there previously, but I'm not sure if it was there by default. 209% increase in malicious VBA files, so that's another automation tool that you can have, Visual Basic for Applications. 146% increase in samples targeting Linux. So Linux, because I guess it's becoming more popular, is becoming more popular for the malware authors as well. 97% increase in malicious PDF files. PDF files are a huge vehicle for getting malware out there, and so you really do have to watch for that. Interestingly, malicious Android samples actually decreased, and attackers seem to be transitioning from Word files to Excel files to hold Visual Basic for Application and things like that. So that was kind of interesting. Next slide. I think I had one more on there.
Yes, coming, sorry.
Yeah, okay. So I thought it was interesting, too, what they listed as key defenses as they see it for, and these are the ones that are on more of the consumer end. There were some more that were more on the corporate side of things. But from the consumer end, they really highlighted vulnerability patching is critical, especially with that dropping the zero-day attacks are out there. You really have to be on top of the applications that are installed on your computer to make sure that they are patched for any security vulnerabilities as quickly as possible. And they highlighted education against phishing and social engineering. And we probably don't have to preach to the choir here that you're all here sharing knowledge. And I think that's great that we share that knowledge to help each other to avoid phishing attacks, social engineering. The URL to the report is there, and I will paste that into the chat.
Chris, Stefan has a comment on your modal dialog boxes.
He
says that in Visual Basic for Applications, if you open a form with modal mode, the code, the macro code, stops at that line and waits for the user to close the dialog box before it continues to the next line of code.
Okay.
But if you open a form with no modal, the form opens and then the next line of code is executed.
Oh, okay. Interesting. I'm not sure, I'm still not sure exactly how that necessarily affects me or a designer's choice, I guess. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Well, okay. if you're running a macro that somebody's designed, that would be the behavior of the macro.
Okay.
Maybe the programmer doesn't want that to happen.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Thank you, Stefan.
Okay. All right. Next share from Chris.
Yet another one. And then I'll shut up. So I found this at the Google Fonts site, and I thought it was really, really well done. So there's a site on using fonts. And so the URL is at the bottom of the screen there, and I'll paste that into the chat as well. But if you go there, they have a really great amount of information about typography. So they break it up into three main sections and a glossary. So introducing type, and they start off with why should you care about typography? And it's very easy to read stuff. So you can read that, and you can say, yeah, okay, I should care. Because you're trying to get a message across, and they talk about how good typography can aid reading. They talk about the type anatomy, classifications, how the different classifications they have for different types of fonts, punctuation. You know, it's fascinating the amount of information they had on different punctuation, weights and styles and so forth. And then you get into choosing type, and so you look at emotive considerations. You know, what different typefaces might have different emotions attached to them. And so depending on what it is you're writing, if it's a business report, it might be different than a kid's birthday party, for example. Talking about how you choose, your width, optical sizes. They talk about pairing different typefaces together and things like that. And then in using type, talking about, the language support that is there or not there in various applications and so forth. Talk about things like line length, how long a line should you actually have and what other factors in typography affect how long you should really limit your lines to. Tracking and kerning, which is, spreading things out or closing in letters together so that they're optically more similar in the gaps between them. Widows, orphans, so forth. They have a huge, huge section on typography on the web. So they have a number of pages devoted to that. I just encapsulated it into just that one thing, but they have an awful lot of information. So web designers, I would highly recommend you take a look at that typography on the web. And then a glossary. So really, really good site for anybody that's interested in learning more about typography.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. And now we have a special treat. Bob Benson, I think, aided and abetted by Bob Harris, is going to talk about security cameras and how to install them. So, Bob, if you want to share your screen, take it away.
Just a minute.
Okay. We see your desktop.
Okay. Just a minute. It didn't come up here. Just a second.
Didn't come up there either.
There it is.
You just hit F5 It'll go into slideshow mode.
Ah, there it goes. Check.
There we go.
Perfect.
My computer's a little slow. Okay. Good evening, Computer Club. My name is Bob Benson. The presentation I am about to show you is my experience in installing these WISE cameras outside my house. This camera that you're seeing here is what a lot of people have seen in the past in this light here. And this one is the one that we've used on the outside of my house. And they're actually a lot smaller. In this program here, we're going to cover camera physical installation, the camera setup, and the camera app features.
Mm.
Now, this here, the box that the camera come in, it shows you it's both good for inside and outside. The WISE cam, it cost me $46.98 each for both, for the camera, so times two. And then the SD card that was $12.50 each. Now, this part here, the four sides of the box has all the stuff on it that they are telling you what it has in that, and it gives you two-way audio, free cloud storage for 12-second videos, motion and sound detection, person detection, and can get full-length motion recording, color night vision. As you can see on the box, the camera is designed to work both inside and outside. This can be used with Google Play or download on the App Store. So this part here, when we unboxed it, you took the camera out of the box. And then you can see you got both screws with it. The power cord, it's 6 feet long, so you go from 110 volt plug to cord, and it plugs into the cord coming out of the camera. You have a quick start guide to help you set up the cameras. So it's got everything with it pretty well. And this cord here, it is good for outside also. So you
which cord? The USB?
Sorry. Okay. Now, this part here, if you tilt the camera up to where you're looking at the bottom of the camera, the SD card will, you have to take the SD card plate off. Okay. And this is where the card goes into the camera. Now, on the right side, at the upper part, that is a setup button. And when you're using the guide and everything else, it'll tell you when you have to push that button. So you have to, you know, be able to know where it is. So just, it's easier to see it. And on that part. Now, the quick guide, it's only, doesn't look like much there, but it's eight little sheets there. So let's get all the information. And you download the WISE cam app. You can use, phone or the tablet, whatever, okay, or Android. Now, we scanned the QR code, and that worked very well. I was a little concerned about it, so I was quite happy when it worked, and it was almost right away, so it didn't take long at all. So I was impressed. Now, with being weather, the snow and the ice and everything else that we get in this lovely province, I decided to go with the case, extra case for the weather. And we put the cameras in this case. You'll see it a little bit further down. For the two cameras, it cost us $20 for the outside winter stuff. Now, this is what it looks like when you have it apart. And this is where we were targeting the cameras to go, in the front of the house. And you can see here the two areas that we were aiming for with the cameras. So one to the porch and one to down the laneway. Now, prior to the installation, we checked the Wi-Fi signal at each location and verified and tested it just to make sure they functioned. Temporary extension cord, and no sense putting it all up into place if it's not going to work. Right? Now, this part, this is where we started to have fun. The fun part of the job, we went fishing. So after putting a hole in each side and through the outside of the garage wall, we went fishing the wire to go from outside to inside, okay? So we plugged that in to plug it in inside and have it go into the camera. And as you can see, we hung it upside down with the screws and run the cord out and plugged it into the camera. Now, the cameras were screwed up there, and to make the wife happy, we plugged all the holes. Okay, so anyway, we plugged it with silicone in the walls. Now, inside, this is the wire coming in from number two camera on the left, and it's going to the plug, and the wire from the front camera, number one, is going to the plug there. So it goes up behind the door closure. So the installation was complete. And if you look up the top there, those cameras don't look too bad. They sort of, you know, they're sitting up there and they're out of the way, and take a little bit of work to reach it to do anything with them. So, but you know, that there. This is a 130-degree view looking down the laneway. And this is 1080p pixels, okay, on the front porch, a shot of that. Now, the color night vision is good, okay? Now, this was taken about 8:30 one night, and you can see all the lights were on across the street and different things. Now, it is lit up quite a bit in this area, but it's still good pictures. And on the porch, you got the color night vision. Now, this is when you're setting up the detection zone, okay, you can, if you look on the right, you see the picture of the finger. You can adjust or block out certain squares that you don't want to detect anything there. Like you don't want to be picking up every car going down the street or every dog walking by on the sidewalk. I'm more concerned with people coming up the laneway to disturb the cars or something like that, or coming to the front door. So I leave those areas accessible other areas I block off. So detection settings, the following settings influence event recordings and use this device as a trigger. So you can adjust motion detection sensitivity. It could be lower, it could be higher. If you find there's a problem, whether it's too high or something, lower it down. You have to try it to see how it works. Sound detection, it's a little hard to manage sometimes with the sounds, depending. You don't want everything disturbing you with notifications. Now, you can adjust it to have it on or have it off. Okay. Now, this is a motion person. Notifications work well. Okay. Sound notifications outside, like I said, are tough to manage. But this guy is usually quiet. But do I really want him in the yard? I don't think so. But the camera caught him. Now, this guy here, he's back up on the porch. So this is something, you know, there is a siren built into the system, okay? Now, the thing is, if you're shopping, okay, and nobody is home, so if you're shopping when your cell phone notifies you that there is someone on the porch, you know, you got to determine, is it a friend or is it a foe? So you can look in the camera, in the your app, and figure that out. Now, if it's somebody that you really don't want to have there, you can press that button on the app and sound the siren from where you're at the store or that. And it may scare them off. Okay. If he doesn't leave right away, then press it again. It'll run for about 23, 25, 29 seconds, somewhere in around there. Okay. And it's an option. Now, the second option is call the police. Which one is going to get there faster? You or them? I don't know. But anyway, that is something you have. And this here, it's a 12-second motion detection. Recordings every 5 minutes are stored free of charge for 14 days in the cloud. And the 32-gigabyte Microsoft SD card, it saves 7 days of continuous SD video or 2 days of continuous HD video. So that's what you get. Now, this system seems to work very well for me. And smile, you're on camera. And this is just one of those things, whereas I do play cards a little bit, so I'm wise then some days. So, any questions?
There is a question, Bob. Does it automatically overwrite all the data when the SD card fills up?
Yeah, it just keeps cycling. I've never had to do anything with it. It just keeps going. So you lose that part.
Okay. And Tristan had a comment, not a question. He says, another neat option for cameras are ones that use power over the Ethernet and one network cable for both data and power. But then you need a switch that supports that.
I don't understand the question. Try that again.
Yeah, it wasn't a question. He's just saying another way to do it is using power over Ethernet, where you only need one cable for both data and power.
Ah,
I guess that would be a different camera system altogether.
Yeah.
No, another question for you. Do you ever have any camera dropouts?
Not that I'm aware of. They didn't drop. They haven't dropped out. They run their time span. I've always had them along a goal for quite a while, you know, like the time limit. Anytime there's movement, it keeps picking it up.
Okay, I don't see anything else in the chat. If anybody else has to wait a minute. There's one more. Have you had to deal with many false positives on detected motion?
Yeah, you get the odd thing that, like, what I find the problem is the sound with the wind and that. It depends, and you get movement with snowstorms. So you have to move sensitivity, you have to adjust it.
But I presume on that, though, that all you would end up doing is you're recording it. And
yeah.
So if it's overwriting automatically and you're going to get 2 days of continuous HD or 7 days of standard definition video, then, you know, do you really care if it's recording when there's nothing really going on?
No, it's not bad. It's better to, as a friend of mine says, it's better to have it than not.
Yeah, exactly. And if you have something like a theft or something that you want the recording, then as long as you pick it up within 2 or 7 days, you'll have it.
And the other thing is you can go back in on your video and see exactly what took place. If you see something not there, but you still have a full recording of the everything that's been filmed. Okay. So it's quite an interesting system. It's the first time I've had one. So on that.
We have a question here from Bill. Is there a charge for storing data in the TGE cloud?
In the cloud.
The cloud.
Just a minute. I'll just go back. See if I can go back.
Well, I can go back. Sorry, I've already switched the screens.
Okay. Anyway, right there. It says 12-second motion detection recordings every 5 minutes stored free of charge for 14 days in the cloud. Okay. Now, the other part, you have that, you can store this stuff here. But then, you know, in the card, but you're going to lose it. So, you know, you can also add more to it if you pay the company so much a month. Okay. So there's different options and it's changing all the time. Like when I'm saying changing, they're coming out with new products and different things. So yes.
But when your camera detects motion and starts recording, does it always give you an alert? Because if you've got too many detected motion alerts, that might be annoying or whatever.
Yes. It depends. You can set it up for what you want. If you're away or something like that, you know, you may want more notifications. But whereas, you know, if you're there at the house, it depends on what you're setting it for. I keep some of the settings very low, you know, so you're not notified of everything. So.
Timothy wants to know, can you use a bigger SD card, like 256 gig?
Well, that question I don't know.
That might be a function of the camera and the software, I guess.
Right. I've only tried it with this, and I've had it about 6 months, and I think it has worked very, very well. So it's I've been impressed with the picture quality and stuff. Actually, for Easter, Bugs Bunny stopped by and dropped a little parcel on the front porch, and when he left, he waved. And so anyway, we thought it was quite interesting. I've been searching for about 6 to 8 years to figure out who was Bugs Bunny in the neighborhood. So here we found out.
That 32 gig, it could be a limit because that is the limit for SDHC.
Okay.
And there's anything above that requires SDXC for extended capacity. So it could be a limitation of the reader, the card reader in the camera itself.
Stefan has just posted that the SD card size does depend on the camera. Yeah. And the one he uses is up to 128 gig.
Okay.
Yeah. So maybe the wise one, who knows if it does, you'd have to check the specs on the camera, I guess, to see what maximum size it would take.
Okay.
That was great, Bob. Thank you very much.
Well, you're quite welcome. I'll stop sharing.
You set the bar for people who want to give shares to the club.
Okay.
Oh, actually, I had one question. Do you know if any insurance companies give you a break on your house insurance if you have security cameras?
I don't know. I haven't checked.
You should check with your insurance company. Maybe they'll give you a break.
Yeah. I'll find that out. I just renewed it. I never thought of that one. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. Okay, our final topic we have prepared, it's fairly short. The question came in a couple of days ago. I guess I'll go back to my screen here, sorry. The question came in a couple of days ago, was it possible to encrypt a file or a folder or even an entire flash drive on an Android device? And in particular, could you do that with an OTG on the go flash drive, and if so, what software should be used? So an on the go flash drive, as far as I know, is just one that has a bit like the one that's pictured here. It has both a regular USB and a micro USB connector, so you can plug it directly into a smartphone without an ancillary cable, for example. So I think that I think it's just a regular flash drive when it comes down to storage. And so if you can encrypt a file on a regular flash drive, I'm sure you can do it on an OTG one. But the question is, how do you do it in Android? And no, I put this thing on the members only forum just for a day or so, and I don't think anybody responded. I don't remember seeing anybody. So I did a little look myself, and I found this program called Secret Space Encryptor, SSE. And the problem with encryption algorithms or encryption apps for Android is common to all apps for Android. And you go to Play Store and you look for something like encryption, and you get 1,000 hits. So there are so many apps, which one are you going to choose? There are very few reviews for these things, and even less from what I would consider reputable sources. So kind of sorting through the options that way is a bit of a problem. And then when you do download an app, there's very little documentation often. And if it's a non-intuitive interface, then that can certainly be a problem. So I downloaded two or three different apps, and one that I really like, which is called Xcrypt, which I've used on the Windows platform. It turned out that was actually a paid for app, and all I was really downloading, I didn't know at the time, was a 30-day free trial version. And then another one I downloaded had good reviews on the site they'd never heard of, but it turned out it had so many adverts that it was basically unusable. At least I wouldn't consider using it. So I did find a review of this guy, again on the site I didn't know about, but it sounded kind of interesting, so I downloaded it. And there's a bit of a learning curve to it. And I tell you, the way I do disk encryption is I use Veracrypt. And Veracrypt is a cross-platform encryption application. There's a Windows version, there's a Linux version, so I can use it on both my systems. There's also a version for the Mac and iOS, and there's also a version for the Raspberry Pi. But there is no version for Android. And the thing I like about VeraCrypt is that it basically gives you a container. So you have, it's like having a folder of a certain size, and you can drop files into it, and then it will encrypt the complete container, and it just sits there, and it looks kind of like a file, but it behaves like a folder. So you can encrypt it and decrypt it, and you can access the files and change them and add them and subtract them and do whatever. It turns out this guy can basically do the same thing. However, there's some wrinkles. So you need to, if you want to use it in that kind of manner, it's useful to set it up correctly or set it up in a particular way. So let's say you want to encrypt any folder on your system. So I've got this folder here called AGTemp. It's got a couple of really important files in there. One's a reminder for a book that I'm interested in reading. And the other one is an image I downloaded from the web of a QR code. So they're not terribly secret. But let's suppose that these are sensitive files and I wanted to store them in this folder. And I want to encrypt that folder. So what I want to do is basically encrypt the folder in whatever directory I'm using. So I encrypt my AGTemp folder. And what SSE does, it creates this container. And the container comes up as it looks like a file, and it's called agtemp.enc. And when it creates that container, it wipes out the original AGTemp folder. And it wipes it, so that means it securely deletes it. Because remember, these are sensitive files, so you don't want to just delete them and having them recoverable on the drive. When you decrypt that ENC file, then the SSE program, the app, restores the AGTemp folder, so it's now a normal folder again, and now it deletes the container file. However, to do that, you have to have the appropriate settings. So what we need to do, go into the settings of SSE, and we need to set the path that is used for importing and exporting files. So basically, for my purposes, I would use that as the location where my folder is that I want to encrypt. And then the next thing I want to do is to, when I encrypt a file, I want the destination to be the same as the AGTemp folder, the same as source. And when I decrypt it, I want that to be the same as source as well. So when I restore the encrypted container, I restore my AGTemp folder, and it's still in the same location on my hard drive, on my phone storage, let's say, my Android device storage. And then the other thing to do is to check a couple of boxes to say, wipe the source after encryption. So you encrypt the AGTemp folder, it creates the .enc container, and then it deletes the regular AGTemp folder. It wipes the source after it's been encrypted. And then the other checkbox is to delete the ENC file after you decrypt it. So when you decrypt it and create the regular AGTemp folder again, then you delete the ENC file. So it's kind of automatic. You're encrypting this folder, and then you decrypt it, you get a regular folder, you can play with the files inside the folder, and then when you're finished, you can encrypt it again, and it gets rid of the regular folder, and you're just left with the encrypted container. So I had to figure all that out. It wasn't terribly obvious, but it clearly that's a quite efficient way of encrypting any folder that you want on your system and still be able to use the files fairly easily. So this is what happens when you run the program. You get a number of different options. There's a password vault, so that will be something like KeePass, I guess, for storing all your browser passwords. This is the one I'm interested in right now, is the file encryptor module. So if I click on this, then it basically brings up a list of all kinds of files, folders that are on a drive somewhere. And let's say here I've got my AG temp folder. So I highlight that, I check it, I select it rather. So I select my AG temp folder and then I say encrypt the directory by clicking on the button down here. So now once I've done that, I've got this encrypted folder now. So if I try to open that in a regular file manager, it actually, in my case, the one I used, it thought it was an image file and it couldn't open it. Now, but clearly it's an encrypted file, encrypted folder, an encrypted container, and the regular file managers can't deal with it because it's encrypted. Once you press this encrypted directory, then you get the encrypted file. And then clearly, to do the opposite, you would click on the, when you had agtemp.inc, when you went into the encryptor module, this would now become decrypt. So it's a pretty simple encrypt, decrypt type of system to encrypt any folder on your hard drive. So if you're interested in Android encryption, that's one way to do it. Now, I asked on the website if anybody had any experience with other systems, and I don't know if anybody does.
I have a couple of questions, I guess, about this. Once you've encrypted it, and then you want to access the files in that folder, do you basically unencrypt the entire folder and
right.
then it creates the folder again, unencrypted? And then if you want to re-encrypt them after you've looked at the files or edited the files, you end up re-encrypting the entire folder again?
That's right. That's exactly what you do. It's a
okay.
it's a container that you encrypt and decrypt.
Yeah, okay.
The whole container.
Okay.
Now, I think you can do the same thing with individual files, but
yeah.
if you've got multiple files, to my mind, it's easier to deal with one container.
Okay, now the other thing, and I pasted this into the chat, Android 5 and up supports full disk encryption. And so every Android phone that I've seen, you know, there is an option in the security settings to turn on full disk encryption on it so that at least the, I guess, no SD card that's added to the system would probably be included, but certainly the onboard memory storage would be fully encrypted, and it is all tied to your logon to the device. So if you had a strong password on the device itself, then all your files on that device would be protected as long as you don't unlock it and immediately hand it to somebody. So if you had a strong password and you have a timeout so that, you know, within, you know, 2 minutes of it being idle, it goes and locks or whatever, I would think that would be a more efficient way of going about protecting your files, wouldn't it?
It would, but let's suppose you forget the password. Now you've lost every file on your device. Whereas
yep.
if you forget the password on the container, you've only
True.
Lost the files that are inside that container.
True. And I guess you can also, this would work on files on an SD card, and I'm not sure that the Android full disk encryption would actually deal with SD cards as well. I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if they don't.
No. So Stuart had a question, what's with the autopsy files? I think that must be in the previous slide. Yeah, here. This is actually from the SSE website. So this is not my plan, for example. But, I mean, if this was a coroner, let's say, and he had some autopsy files on his phone, he would probably consider those to be sensitive information, and he'd probably want to encrypt that folder. So I suspect that's why he's done that. And by the same token, if it was me, I would be encrypting location of the holygrail.pdf file soon. Okay, so that was it for the prepared material. So as usual, we're back to any other questions, and we've got 10 minutes now. So any questions, anybody, anywhere?
Yeah, Bob Walker here. Recently came across a neat little product I'd like to share with folks. Would it be okay if I shared the screen? I got a quick slide here.
Sure. Just give me a second here. Yeah, Bob Walker. And okay, you should be able to share now.
Okay.
Got your desktop, Bob?
Got the desktop and got the slide there.
Now we've got the 4 terabyte slide.
Yeah. So came across this a little while ago, and basically it's a 4 terabyte external hard drive. And you look at the size of it there compared to the laptop it's sitting beside. It's nice and small. The one I got is 4 terabytes. It's a USB drive, but it because it's so small, it's powered exclusively from your USB port, unlike some of the big USB drives that require a separate power supply. So that's a very nice feature to have. It's very easy to take it from one computer to another computer to another computer. It comes with all sorts of software for backup, encryption, and some other software that comes with it. You can get the 4 terabyte version at Amazon for only $125. And you have a choice of colors. And they got capacities from 1 terabyte for $70 all the way up to 5 terabytes for $150. So it's a neat little product, and I thought I'd share this. It's USB 3.2, so it's very fast for doing your backups. If you're if the computer it's plugged into will support that, but it's backwards compatible to USB 2 as well. So just a neat little product for doing the backups. And, of course, Alan has showed us in the past some great backup software, as well as the software for synchronizing your files between different machines. So together with those, this is a great solution for doing the backups that we, of course, all should be doing on a regular basis. And you can back up at 4 terabytes. You can back up several computers, or you can have many generations of backups on the same drive, depending on how you want to do things. So I just thought I'd share that with folks.
Are those Canadian dollars, Bob?
Yeah, those are Canadian dollars from Amazon Canada.
That's a good price for that hardware. And Western Digital, I think, is a really good model for hard drives too. I've got several Western Digitals and they work really well.
Yeah, the thing I like about the Western Digitals is that they have hardware-based encryption, and so you can very easily set it up, and then when you plug it in, even if you don't have the software installed on your on the computer, you can just go to, it'll actually show up as a as if it's a CD drive, and so a read-only partition, and there will be an executable in there called, I believe it's unlock.exe or something like that. You double click on it, it'll prompt you for the password, and then you put in the password and you'll end up with another drive letter, which will be the decrypted partition on that drive. I really like the portable drives because of the fact for offsite backup in particular, because I can have that, you know, in trunk of my car or whatever, and all I have to carry in is, you know, the drive and the cable. I don't have to worry about a power supply. And so for offsite backups, I find the portable drives are really, really great. And yeah, I agree. That's a good price for a 4 terabyte portable. The if you don't feel like shopping at Amazon, though, keep an eye on Best Buy, because they'll periodically be on sale. And so they, I don't know if I've ever seen them that cheap for 4 terabytes, but they've been pretty close to that on occasion.
Yeah, the $125 is today's price as of about 15 minutes ago.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
The prices are subject to change. But I've got a few Western Digital MyBook USB hard drives, and they're a fair size. They have each of them has their own power supply. I have one that's called a MyBook Duo, which has two terabyte hard drives in it, which you can set up to have mirrored. So if one hard drive dies, you pop it out, pop another one in, and it automatically synchronizes with the other hard drive. And so even if the hard drive itself fails, your data is all protected. So Western Digital has a lot of great products. They have some other little USB drives that you can plug in. They're just a little nubby sticking out of the side of your laptop or out of the USB port in your car for the sound system. And so you don't have to take them in and out to put your laptop into the case and go cavorting around with it. So they make quite a few good products, and I can't say I've ever had a Western Digital drive of any kind fail on me. And that's over a lot of drives, and use them for several years at work as well. And they make some pretty good products.
The question in the chat, Bob, whether you can use that 4 terabyte drive with a tablet, and I think that must be an Android tablet.
If the tablet will support a USB thumb drive, I expect it will support this as well.
Okay, thanks, Bob. That's great.
And let me there we go.
Okay, there's a question in the chat from Eldon. He says he downloaded WinZip and used it, but didn't want to purchase the product. But now he sees some of these old files have been, quote, locked by WinZip. Does anybody know how to regain access before he downloaded WinZip?
I think WinZip did have the ability to either encrypt using standard ZIP 2.0 encryption or their own encryption. If you use standard encryption, any unzipping program should be able to deal with it. If you use WinZip only, the thing I would try certainly is try reinstalling WinZip on your computer. If it argues that it's, you have to pay for it at that point, try installing it on another computer that hasn't had WinZip on it and transfer the files over to there, and you'll have the 30-day trial or whatever. And I would presume you should be able to do the unzipping at that point, I would guess. Anybody else have opinions on that? Okay, Eldon, you can report back if that works. Install WinZip on another computer and see if you can access your files on that other computer.
So Gillian's saying that she had a small Western Digital drive fail, but called them. It wasn't even showing up on the computer, but the agent was very helpful and was able to get it resolved and reformatted. Great service.
Yeah, surprisingly good, I think.
Okay,
while we wait for other questions to come in, how about do the wrap-up slides?
Yeah, I'm just trying to share my screen to do that.
Okay.
Okay, so if you... these things. May the 2nd coming up is our second OPCUG Tech Talk. And this is Linda going to be talking about basic photo editing. So for all you members out there, if you haven't registered for this and you're interested in how to do photo editing, this is a great opportunity. So May the 2nd at 7 p.m. And I just remind you that you have to register, because we're only sending out the Zoom login credentials to people who are pre-registered. And that's basically because we're charging non-members a $20 fee with a free membership. So if you're interested in that photo editing session, register anytime and members at no charge.
And if you have any questions about the session, Linda's online tonight. So if you have any questions, feel free to ask away before we conclude tonight's call. And maybe Linda can fill in with some answers.
Okay, and our next regular meeting, the May meeting, is going to be quite special. It's Gillian Villeneuve from the Macintosh User Group of Ottawa going to be talking about me and my Mac. And I don't remember anybody ever talking about Mac computers at an IBM PC user group meeting. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. I've heard lots about Macs, but I know absolutely nothing about them other than their really high-end stuff and really high-end price. So we'll see if there's anything different to say than that. And then the final slide I have is just a reminder that next week, the 27th, we'll have another Q&A. Right now, I don't think there's anything in the pipe. So if you got enthusiastic about security camera presentations and you want to do something similar, you have a whole week to put something together and send us some information to suggestion box at opcug.ca.
And really,
unless there's something else, Chris. Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I'd like to echo that is if you have anything that you think is kind of neat, hardware, software, a service, why not share it with your fellow members? If you want to take a chance on whether there's time available or not, you can do like Bob, and just if there's time available, do a quick share afterwards or a discussion about something. Let's all share our knowledge so we can all benefit from other people's experiences. And
okay,
I don't
well,
see
everybody enjoyed the session, and we'll see you next week.